Hey guys, welcome to Latin America Review, our weekly program. We've been doing a podcast for a couple months now, and today we're going to be doing a live stream, which will of course be one of our podcasts, and we're doing it on Nicaragua. So there's a lot of things we've been wanting to report with regards to Nicaragua, but of course we don't have all the resources to be able to attack some of these big headlines and some of the misunderstandings, the misrepresentations, and of course the fake news about Nicaragua from the mainstream media, from the international media. And, you know, we devote a lot of our time to making videos and doing translations, but we hope that this year we can do a lot more coverage on Central America in general and on Nicaragua specifically. So for that reason, today we're bringing on my good friend and comrade, John Perry. Thank you so much for coming on with us, John Perry.
Good to be with you, Camila.
So I'll provide a little bit of an introduction. I've known John for a couple of years, but I think he's been doing this work for a whole lot longer. And we've been in contact recently because of our overlapping work. And he's lived in Nicaragua for 20 years. He's been writing about Central America since the coup in Honduras in 2009. And he writes for a number of different outlets, London Review of Books, Council on Hemispheric Affairs, and FAIR.org, and Covert Action, among others. So today we have a couple of headlines and things I wanted to discuss. And, you know, well, before we get into the headlines, today is Friday. And of course, every Friday, the Nicaraguan government has been coming out and announcing that they will not be raising the price of fuel. As you know, John, because since this conflict began overseas about a year ago, we've seen, you know, fluctuations in prices everywhere that have really affected working people. And Nicaragua Sandinista government has wanted to ensure that this wouldn't affect the people of Nicaragua, transport workers, small business owners, entrepreneurs, or whatever you'd like to call them. And I think it's a very important policy. Tell us a little bit before we go into some of the things I brought up that I wanted to discuss with you. Tell us a little bit about your story of how long. You said you've been in Nicaragua for 20 years. And are you a citizen now, John?
Yes, I'm a citizen. I'm married to a Nicaraguan, which is one of the main reasons I've been here for 20 years. And I've been a citizen since about 2 years ago. So I was able to vote in the last general election in 2021. Nicaragua is a great place to live. We've had our problems. As you know, 2018 was very difficult. There was an attempted coup against the government. In Masaya, where I live, we suffered particularly badly for the 3 month period when the country was full of roadblocks that were guarded by people with weapons, sometimes serious heavy weapons, and we were threatened. Other people were threatened. Friends of ours had their houses burnt down, and that was pretty bad. But that was one exceptional period. The rest of the time, as you probably know, it's the most peaceful country in Central America, and it's recovered that position since 2018. And until the pandemic, it was a tourist destination for many people from North America and elsewhere. And tourism is starting to recover again. So I was in Granada a couple of weeks ago and saw plenty of North American tourists and European tourists. And of course, we hope more will come because we desperately need to recover Nicaragua's economic position after the effects of the coup in 2018 and the pandemic.
Absolutely. So the reason I thought of doing this episode today, sort of last minute, was that I saw the decision made by the National Assembly of Nicaragua yesterday to ban the bringing in the entry of binoculars and TV cameras. And if you bring in TV cameras now into Nicaragua, you have to get, I believe, authorization from the Cinemateca Nacional. And so this is something that immediately came out, I think, in Salvadoran media. I have family members who send me those headlines. And, you know, it obviously will come out in Miami-based media, in the U.S., Spanish language media. And, you know, they always kind of tell us half of the story. And so I think it's really important to, like, talk about why Nicaragua has the sort of policies it has. And I also think it's important to, you know, to show that I think some of the policies that Nicaragua has, a lot of them, are actually things that would be very popular in other countries. And we've heard calls for these sorts of things, such as in the case of banning NGOs and these sorts of foreign entities from operating in different countries. And as popular as they are in different parts of Latin America that have faced destabilization and coup attempts and foreign meddling, whenever we've posted things about this on social media, we get a lot of response from people from different African countries and around the world who have faced similar things. So I wanted to ask you about some of this. I guess let's start with that one. If you heard, what have you heard so far about this banning of entering with these different things, these different items, binoculars and TV cameras, as like a tourist going into Nicaragua? Have you heard very much on that so far?
And I think at the moment it's a little bit confusing what the new rules are, because I've seen two versions of them. But as I understand it, the ban on binoculars is just on night vision binoculars that might be used for, you know, dubious purposes. And I understand that the question about cameras and movie cameras is more open than was first suggested, and the Vice President Rosario Murillo was saying that she welcomed people doing documentaries, for example. So I think we'll just need to see exactly what the rules are. But what you said is right, that the government has been responding to the violent attacks that took place in 2018. And before 2018, you know, the government was, Nicaragua was very open country. People could join NGOs and take part in NGOs that were funded by foreign governments. They were doing all sorts of dubious things, and there was very little control over what happened. And this led to the violence in 2018, when it turned out that many NGOs funded by the US government or government agencies were planning the violence and been training young people to take part in the violent demonstrations and the attempted coup. So, of course, what's happened since then is that the government's been tightening up, and it gets blamed for that by the US government and the corporate media. But really, this tightening up and the arresting of people who've been found to be guilty of not declaring where their funds are coming from, the closure of some NGOs, and some of the other restrictions that have taken place, these measures are really very popular in amongst ordinary Nicaraguans. Nicaragua was a peaceful country, as I said, before 2018. And of course, when you've gone through the violence that took place in 2018, people want to get back to the peaceful situation as quickly as they can. So they accept some of these restrictions that the government has had to impose.
Let me just read some of the comments. I'm not on my computer, so it's taking me longer to manipulate the computer here. But Punkadelic 2 says, good to see more content about Nicaragua. And another comment by Punkadelic, safer than Costa Rica and Panama. I mean, yeah, that's definitely the case. And I think that people realize that when they go on delegations or they visit for the first time, it's just immediately clear, especially if you've spent time in Latin America and different countries. It can be really difficult to, you know, be out at night in major cities and travel around the country, especially by bus. You know, these are sorts of issues that Nicaraguans don't really face. And I think it's kind of like night and day, I would say. Where Bolivia is a relatively safe country as well, but I think it's just absolutely astounding how the government has so much territorial control and how safe it is. So do you recall, I guess we were all there in 2021 in November for the elections. And I think that was when CNN was actually blocked from entering, and they made a big deal about it. They did a news report about it, and essentially they were trying to get into the country unannounced, coming in through Honduras. And so they were stopped and they were not allowed to enter. I think, you know, just on the basis that they didn't, you know, in any way announce that they were going to come and sort of apply for credentials as a journalist, announce their intentions. They were kind of just sneaking in. And this is a problem in all countries. But, you know, when it happens to a big network like CNN and it happens in Nicaragua, there's potential for people to distort that that event and, you know, make it seem like, of course, like this is an authoritarian government, a dictatorship. They don't let you cover anything. Then in 2022, the telecommunication authority in Nicaragua took CNN off the airwaves. And I don't know, John Perry, do you remember, do you recall the reasons behind that? Because I can think of many reasons why CNN and other press outlets might not be considered journalistic or truthful. But do you recall what they said when that happened there?
Well, this goes back again to 2018, because before 2018, and indeed during the violence in 2018, the corporate media were coming freely into Nicaragua. But of course, they weren't reporting fairly on what was going on. I talked to the reporter from The Guardian who came to Masaya in, I think it was May or June 2018. And I tried to get him to understand the problems that were being caused by the violent roadblocks that had been set up in Masaya. But he'd been kind of captured at the airport by the opposition, who are very well equipped to talk to journalists. They, you know, often have good English, have good contacts with the international media. And they shipped him around Masaya themselves. They showed him a completely false picture of what was going on. They provided police sharpshooters, supposedly, who were attacking the opposition roadblocks, and gave him a completely fake story. And he went away and repeated this fake story. And this happened with many reporters who came into the country. They were kind of captured by the opposition and fed a completely false line. And I think the government, you know, simply got completely tired of this, because I follow the Guardian, as I'm from England myself, and it had something like about 30 stories about Nicaragua over the course of 2018, 2019, and not a single one reported the real position in the country. All of them were slanted towards the opposition. And, of course, in a way, while we worry about the international impact of what the corporate media say, what the government worries about is the impact locally. And it was undoubtedly the case that in April 2018, when the violence first began, the social media in particular, but corporate media as well, were very successful in convincing people that the police were killing demonstrators, peaceful demonstrators. And many Sandinista supporters initially had doubts about what the government was doing. And it was only after a period of weeks that it really became clear what was really happening. And it was the demonstrators who were provoking the violence. So, you know, it's very good to talk about a free press and allow complete freedom. But when it's abused in the way it was in Nicaragua and actually leads to violence and death, which is what happened in 2018, it's understandable, I think, that the government takes these sorts of measures.
Yeah, and at the same time, you know, Nicaraguan accounts, you know, those sorts of accounts that were expressing support for the Sandinista revolution at the time of their election, their presidential election in November 2021, were censored. They were subject to censorship in that they were completely suspended and taken off Twitter and Facebook, all at the same time and without any reason. Some of these accounts were quite big. You know, whether, you know, I'm not really sure what the justification was, because we've heard when this took place against Venezuelan and Cuban accounts, they said that they were spam and they were repeating some of the same messages over and over. But, you know, we know this to not be true because some of the people who were censored are people we know in real life. You probably do as well. And then, you know, in the case of, you know, some of these countries, it was actual government accounts that were censored or very large news networks. In other cases, it's news anchors. In this case, for Nicaragua, it was just a lot of regular citizens who were just expressing support for President Daniel Ortega, who was at the time running for re-election. And, you know, there was no real outcry. And it's a little bit like upsetting and, you know, frustrating for me because I feel like I've been trying to raise the level of awareness about the sorts of censorship that Latin American, you know, governments and people supportive of these different revolutionary projects have faced. And, you know, we're only starting to hear a lot of outcry about censorship now because it's just become so obvious in the case of the Russian media outlets that have been censored. But those Russian outlets, and of course, Iran, Iranian news outlets have also been censored for years. It all started, you know, years ago. I remember it in 2017 when all this started to take place on the different principal platforms, which are YouTube, Facebook, Twitter. And so we're only like hearing a lot about it since the beginning of the Ukraine conflict, but it's been happening for some time. And also it's probably the case that in addition to, you know, having accounts suspended or restricted, that, you know, this sort of content is almost, you know, absolutely not being promoted anyway. And if there's any sort of algorithm that it's not going to, you know, it's not going to compete with the other source of accounts and the information that is being actively promoted by those who control these outlets. So, you know, CNN, among other outlets, are not Nicaraguan. They don't have, you know, they're not owned by the Nicaraguan people. They don't serve or represent any of the interests of the people of Nicaragua or Latin America in general. And I just don't, I don't know, I can't think of any arguments to really have them there because most people can find other ways to see this sort of content, and they're going to see it regardless because a lot of this information is just widely reproduced. But I would say that in a lot of other countries, such as Bolivia, Venezuela, and Cuba, it's almost absurd to see these sorts of you know, so-called news outlets continuing to operate given just the disinformation that they've disseminated for so many years. So I think it's a very positive development. However, if there was any outcry about that, I'm not really sure because I don't really know who even cares about CNN anymore. People should know that Nicaragua still has a lot of right-wing media. So there are some, there's a healthy share of opposition views. Can you tell us a little bit about, you know, what media exists there?
Yes, well, it's important, I think, to have a view about where the government can intervene and when it can't, where it can't intervene. And a small government, a government of a small country like Nicaragua, has very limited powers. It can control television channels, and it can control printed newspapers. And there was only one printed newspaper in Nicaragua, but it can't control what happens on the internet. And so, you know, the internet was, Facebook in particular, which is very popular in Nicaragua, was massively used to promote the violence in 2018. And then, of course, as you said, Facebook was one of the principal means of censorship of discussion leading to the elections in 2021, when dozens of accounts were closed, not just in some cases government accounts, but also Sandinista sympathizers who were writing or speaking in Spanish in support of the Sandinista government and its re-election. What I think the government has actually been pretty balanced in its approach, because there are still television channels, radio channels, and of course the whole internet providing alternative views. And I think some of the government action has actually had some effects on some of those channels. Channel 10, for example, which is a popular television channel, which is independent, and was violently anti-government until a year or two back, has become more balanced in its approach. And you can now hear favourable news items on Channel 10 that you couldn't hear before. And it is more balanced. And I think that in a way, that's a good effect of what the government has been trying to do. But, you know, there's still Facebook, WhatsApp, Twitter and so on, where the whole of the internet is actively engaged in trying to undermine the Sandinista government. And of course, the government can do very little about that. And it was, it was proven in 2018 that there were hundreds of thousands of fake news items being sent, often from out of the country, many of them from out of the country. And the government was completely taken by surprise by that and didn't know initially how to respond.
So I'll read out a couple more comments from Punkadelic 2. The Guardian is awful. I had the wrong impression about Nicaragua and the events of 2018 for a long time because I was consuming media like Democracy Now! And The Guardian and the BBC, etc. He says, and then in 2020, I started to change my views and the way I saw those kinds of events. A big part of why I realized how I had been wrong before was because of Kasacha News' coverage and the coup in Bolivia and how that prompted me to reassess things. So, absolutely. And it's, as you said, you know, in Nicaragua, everybody is very much on their cell phones, online all the time, especially young people, just like anywhere else. And so they're spending all of their time on Facebook and Instagram, and perhaps to a lesser extent, Twitter, because of course, Twitter in Latin America is not used as heavily as in the United States, but it's still used. Obviously a lot of Sandinistas, like we said, have accounts. A lot of opposition people in Nicaragua use Twitter very heavily because they know that that's how you get a hold of news outlets in the United States, other sort of right-wing actors and politicians from around the region. And they're always, you know, seeking that sort of support and, campaigning around online kind of permanently against the Sandinista government. And there's also a lot of, you know, Nicaraguan opposition people living in the United States. And so they use these platforms very heavily as well. And, you know, I think what we're, I don't know if you would say we're already seeing this, but it's kind of, you know, what we've seen for a very long time in Cuba, which is that it's very difficult for them to go for, you know, Cuba's enemies, those people who are, of course, against the Cuban Revolution, based in Miami, and of course, the United States government. It's very difficult for them to make their way into Cuba these days to try to start some sort of an uprising or protest movement against the revolutionary government. So they have to plan these things from abroad, and they are planning these things from Miami and Washington, and sometimes Madrid and other places as well. And I think, you know, that's what they're having to do now in the case of Nicaragua. A lot of these disinformation campaigns that we've seen in recent years have come, you know, straight from, English speakers in the United States who have access sometimes to some of these different news platforms, such as NACLA, such as Democracy Now!, and many others that are unfriendly to Nicaragua. So that's kind of their approach right now. So I wanted to move on, John, so that we can talk a little bit about what some of the things are that the Sandinista government is working on now. You mentioned a couple of things to me earlier in our conversation, but do you want to tell us, what do you think is some of the most important things that I think are getting perhaps overshadowed by these international news headlines?
Well, it indeed, because this month is the 16th anniversary of the re-election of the Sandinista government in 2007, January 2007. So we've had, apart from the interruption in 2018 and the damage that was caused then and by the pandemic, we've had 16 years of progress and recovery for the country from the previous 16 years of neoliberal government, when much of the country's public services were destroyed. The railroad was literally sold off to the Japanese. I mean, literally, the rails were dug up and sold. The health and education services were wound down, and people were charged for medicines and charged to go to school, and all sorts of privatization measures were implemented. So the government, the Sandinista government, faced a tremendous task when it came back into power in 2007. And I think it's done a tremendous job, and this is why it was re-elected with a big majority in November 2021. For example, in health care, the government has either built or is building 24 new hospitals, all public hospitals, and they're very good quality hospitals. I had cause to go to one of them, and they're very good indeed, and they're probably some of the best hospitals in Latin America. We successfully dealt with the COVID pandemic. The level of excess deaths in Nicaragua was one of the lowest in Latin America. And once vaccines became available, the government have been very successful in getting the country vaccinated. So we've got the highest level of vaccination in Central America, and higher levels than countries like Costa Rica and Panama, which are wealthier than Nicaragua. So, you know, people want to preserve those kind of benefits. We've seen just this last week, when the school year started, 1.8 million children went to school. And if they went to a public school, the majority went to, of course, go to public schools, then they'll be getting a free school meal for everybody. And they'll get a free rucksack and exercise books and pencils and so on for them for what they need in the school. And these services didn't exist under the neoliberal governments. And of course, school attendance fell down very badly. There was no help with getting uniforms. Now, children who haven't got uniforms can get help to buy them and have school shoes, for example. And this has raised school attendance massively. And now education is free right the way through to adult level. So just down the road from where I live, there's a new technical college being built, which will teach agricultural sciences, because Nicaragua is still very much a farming country and wants to improve its food security, which is already very high. So the government is investing in technical education, which is free, and adults can study free of charge in the evenings and weekends. So these are the kind of achievements which have been made over the last 16 years that really make it not as surprising at all that the Sandinista government was returned with such a big majority in 2021. And of course, the corporate media and the US government called the elections in 2021 a sham, because they simply couldn't accept that a government that they describe as communist could be so popular and be elected with such a big majority. But, you know, that's the reality of the situation here. People, even the people who aren't actively Sandinista, the majority nevertheless believe that the Sandinista government is the best way of achieving the stability and economic prosperity that people want to recover after the damage done by the pandemic, and before that, the violence in 2018.
So we have a hello, Camila and John, from Terry Matson, our friend who also has done a great job of covering Nicaragua and Latin America generally with her weekly program. Comment from Punkadelic that says, I remember reading NACLA and Jacobin in particular in 2018 and their articles presenting Nicaragua in the same way as the BBC, CNN, New York Times, etc. And of course, it's a huge problem because a lot of people now consider these sorts of alternative media platforms to be more credible. People have moved away from a lot of the mainstream media, or they believe they have. And so they're looking to these sorts of platforms, which are kind of taking the same angle. We have another hello, greetings from Berlin. Was very impressed by Nicaragua's approach to COVID. Keep up the spirit. And here's a question. Appreciate the coverage from Jeff Beal. and reporting on this issue. I'm wondering what you think of reports of Ortega jailing so many of his political opponents and former Sandinista leaders. What do you think about that, John?
Well, to give some context to this, we have to go back to 2018 and even before that. So that if you take the perhaps the emblematic case is Dora Maria Tellez, who was a Sandinista guerrilla fighter alongside Daniel Ortega in the Revolutionary War. And indeed, I believe she claims that she saved his life. But, you know, people like her, unfortunately, changed radically when the Sandinistas lost power in 1990 after the revolution and after the Contra War, which put so much pressure on the economy and on society and caused 30,000 deaths in Nicaragua in the 1980s. When the Sandinistas lost power, a lot of former Sandinistas turned against the Sandinista party and moved further and further to the right, so that people like Dora Maria ended up in the early 2000s supporting right-wing candidates in the elections in Nicaragua. And then they also started to meet with the US embassy to plan regime change as soon as the Ortega government returned to power in 2007. So you had that period of about 10 years whilst the coup or the attempted coup in 2018 was being planned, when people like Dora Maria and the people who'd been in the so-called Sandinista renovation movement were meeting the US ambassador and actively plotting how they could get rid of the then Sandinista government. And this part of this story, of course, as you mentioned, Camila, is the NGOs that were either set up or already existed, which started to get very substantial fundings, I mean, millions of dollars from USAID, from the National Endowment for Democracy during this period. And what they started to do was both to support right-wing and opposition media, like La Prensa, the newspaper, like Confidencial, like 100% Noticias, the news channel, and also to train young people. So they lured thousands of young people into training courses by offering them training, free education in English, free training about democracy and civic society and how to promote civic society. And the people who went to these courses, some of them realized that it was really a big propaganda scheme to try and train young people to hate their government. And of course, they were successful in this. And indeed, in June 2018, during the coup attempt, the National Endowment for Democracy, in a presentation to the US Congress, actually bragged that 7,000 or 8,000 of people, young people that they trained, were taking part in the violent protests in Nicaragua. So it's not a myth that this happened. It really did happen. And unfortunately, these, in many cases, it was former Sandinistas who were backing these this violence and these attempts. And indeed, on the first day when violence occurred during the coup attempt, which was April the 18th, Dora Maria Tellez was here in Masaya giving supplies to groups of young people who'd been brought in to attack Sandinistas with stones and handheld mortars, which was really the start of that that violent period, which within a few weeks led to the whole city being closed down and people being unable to move around or do very much at all.
Yeah, and well, just generally, I have to say that we hear these same sorts of claims being made or questions about why would President Ortega's own former comrades, oppose him today. And we've heard the same thing in every country. Quite frankly, in Bolivia, half of the country is part of the MAS. Half of the country, more than half, has supported Evo Morales and the movement towards socialism for the last 16 years or whatever it is. And so, yes, there are times when some of the people who decide to leave the party or the movement will go and start their own faction, never to get really off the ground or to be able to put forth a real presidential contender or candidate. And in most parts of the country, can't really produce people who will win elections. And I think it's just a moot point, to be honest, that a lot of people like to focus on is, and it happened, Venezuela has experienced this as well. Somebody was a Chavista, they supported Chavez, they were a good ally, friend, or advisor to Chavez. And today they say that they don't support the Bolivarian government led by President Nicolas Maduro. I mean, it's just, it happens here and there. And when it does, it dominates headlines for like 5 years, 10 years. And it's the only thing anyone wants to talk about. But it doesn't represent the sentiment within the country. The vast majority of people within Nicaragua strongly approve of the Sandinista government, and specifically Daniel Ortega, as well as Rosario Murillo. So this really is, you know, largely a very small minority position that's being amplified on the exterior. We have a much love from South Africa from Anarchist. Punkadelic says, some of those that fought alongside Castro and Che in the Sierra Maestra, let me put it up here, ended up betraying the revolution. It doesn't happen like that. Unfortunately, revolutionary governments always have to be on guard. That's definitely the case everywhere. And another comment, end the Ned. So
let me say a little bit more about some of the people who turned against the Sandinista government. I think it's important to remember that when elections were taking place during the neoliberal period and Sandinistas were trying to regain power at the ballot box, then the MRS, the Sandinista Renovation Movement, was standing as well and never got more than 1 or 2% of the votes. So they tried the electoral method of getting back into power unsuccessfully, and then I think became increasingly desperate and therefore turned to getting help from the US embassy in order to overthrow or prevent Daniel Ortega from returning to power. When that was unsuccessful, they were then wanted to unseat him. And something else I ought to mention is that when the violence took place in 2018, then some of the people who are now in prison were actually guilty of very severe violence and even murder in 2018. Medardo Moreno, who's one of those who's currently in prison, was responsible for organizing an attack on a police station, which led to 4 deaths and 9 policemen being kidnapped, for example. And after 2018, the government had an amnesty in June 2019, and 400 political prisoners, as they were dubbed by Amnesty International, were released. But they were released conditionally on the basis that anybody either released or who was given, was given exoneration from the crimes they committed would stop organizing violent activities. And the people who are now in prison again are ones who will continue to organize that violence. And of course, most of them were in prison just before the elections in November 2021, when there was a big risk of violence, and many people were worried that violence was going to occur during the elections themselves. So despite the attention that these arrests get internationally, within Nicaragua, there's very little concern about them, and indeed many people support the arrests having been taken place.
Yes, people in Nicaragua do support the arrests, and they say, you know, when they're telling the story of what happened in 2018, they say that they wish and they had called upon the government to do more faster in terms of deploying the security forces to end the violence in the streets, and they wanted to just go back to work, back to school, return to normal, not have to live in fear. And they were just practically begging the government to do something, and they're not sure why it took so long, but they say that if this is to happen, were it to happen ever again, that they would, well, first of all, that it's never going to happen again, but if it is, that they're going to take immediate action to stop this, because, you know, it was literally terrorism and violence by a small minority, but inflicted on the general population in several points across the country. And people are really angry about it. They're extremely, hostile, frustrated about what took place. And anyone who goes there can speak to many people and hear from them their experiences as I've been able to. If anyone has any questions, throw them in the chat. I wanted to ask you, John, I saw that our friends at Friends of the ATC have organized a new upcoming delegation. And this one's going to be Nicaraguan Caribbean Coast delegation. It's in June. They're going to go, they'll start in Managua, but then we'll be going to the Pacific Coast. They'll be going to Bluefields and many other places. It's a 10-day delegation. It seems like a very great experience. They'll be going to the Southern Caribbean Coast Autonomous Region. Well, can you tell us a little bit about, have you had the opportunity to spend much time on the Caribbean coast, and what might they get to see there?
No, I haven't, unfortunately. But the interesting thing is that now, for the first time, really last year, the west of Nicaragua, the Pacific side, which is where most of the population live, is properly connected to the Caribbean side, the eastern side of the country, which has got a much smaller population, and traditionally has not been Spanish speaking. So many people speak English, and many people speak indigenous languages. And it's been very interesting the way that the government has put very much in emphasis on development of the Caribbean coast. The Caribbean coast is very vulnerable to hurricanes. So we've had a succession of severe hurricanes over the last few years. It seems to be a feature of climate change that the Caribbean coast in particular is getting hit by more hurricanes. And the government's disaster prevention methods have really meant that there have been very few deaths from these hurricanes, in contrast with Honduras, which had been hit in the same way, but where hundreds of people have died in many occasions. And the government has been building new hospitals. It's improved the roads. It's really built the roads for the first time. There's now a paved road, or two paved roads, to the Caribbean coast, built a massive bridge over a river that would have to be crossed by ferry before. And this was reflected in the election results in 2021, when the Caribbean, the national result was, I think, 75% in favour of the Sandinista government. But on the Caribbean coast, the vote was 84-85% in favour of the Sandinista government. And this was in regions which historically had been opposed to the Sandinistas. During the revolutionary period, there was a lot of animosity towards the Sandinista movement on the Caribbean coast, and indeed the Contra movements during the 1980s drew a lot of its support from the indigenous communities. So really the government has turned the situation round, and I think the delegation that's going there in later this year will see the results of that, and it will be very interesting for them, I think, to see the different kind of culture on the Caribbean coast, but also how now it's integrated into the rest of Nicaragua.
Yeah, I'm very envious of this delegation that's taking place, because these are all places that I haven't had the opportunity to visit, like yourself. Ben Juarez says, Viva Nicaragua Sandinista y Revolucionario. A question that I was going to ask you, Punkadelic, has just asked. So I wanted to go in this direction as we wrap things up, because I think it's very interesting and something we haven't touched on. But, during SALAC, Xiomara Castro, she said thank you to many of the countries that supported, the left-wing government of Mel Zelaya during the coup. And she obviously named Comandante Daniel Ortega as one of those people, among Chavez, Evo, the president at the time of Dominican Republic, and many others of that sort of pink tide era, who supported Zelaya during the coup and the subsequent dictatorship. And now, of course, they're back in power. And I think this relationship is so important to highlight. So Punkadog's question is, what has been the relationship like so far between the Sandinista government and the new government of Xiomara Castro in Honduras? And then maybe you can mention, if you happen to have been following, like, you know, some, what are some of the challenges that Honduras is facing right now, you know, and what its position kind of in Latin America is. You know, obviously we know it's a left-wing government, as was, you know, the government that was ousted in the coup, but this is following this very long period of a dictatorship in which very, you know, the ties were strengthened between Honduras and the United States at a time when during the Zelaya government, they were turning towards Venezuela and had very strong relations with, of course, the leftist and socialist forces of the region. So I think they're kind of in an interesting spot right now. So tell us what you know about Honduras and Nicaragua.
Yes, well, it's interesting that Xiomara made the comment about Nicaragua supporting Mel Zelaya when he was subject to that coup in 2009, because yes, indeed, he attempted to cross from Nicaragua into Honduras, and then later on did cross and established himself in the Brazilian embassy in Tegucigalpa. So the alliance was very strong at that time. And I think the alliance is strong again now, but it's rather a sort of clandestine alliance. Obviously, Honduras and Xiomara Castro are playing a careful game of trying to keep the United States on their side, because the United States is so intrinsically involved in Honduras with the massive US base that they have there, and of course, many, many commercial interests. And so I think she's, you know, really got a very difficult job on the international stage of showing that she is aligned with Venezuela, Cuba, and Nicaragua. But at the same time, being very careful about this so that she doesn't disturb too much the semi-alliance that still exists with the United States. And of course, you know, she has to kind of, I suppose, suppress her anger at the states for the way that they supported the dictatorial governments of Juan Orlando Hernandez for so many years before she won the election in 2021. So I think that there is a close relationship between the two governments, but it's not a relationship you're going to read very much about. But you can see that, you know, the press talk about the vice ministers meeting each other, police chiefs meeting each other, the army has been meeting with the Honduran army. There's clearly a lot of contact taking place. And I think, for example, that Honduras urgently wants to learn some of Nicaragua's policing methods, because Nicaragua, as you know, Camila, has been very successful in keeping out of the country the violent gangs that plague Honduras and El Salvador, Guatemala, and now I believe parts of Mexico. They simply don't have a foothold in Nicaragua, and that's largely because of the community policing methods which the police service uses. And I know there have been contacts between Honduran and Nicaraguan police to try and develop those methods in Honduras. But of course, it depends on a massive cultural change that Xiomara has got to create in the security forces and the police in Honduras, who were used to serving what was effectively a dictatorship. And of course, many of them were trained in the states and you know, have equipment that was supplied by the states and so on. So she's got an enormous task. And I don't envy her, and I think she's doing very well so far, but clearly there are many challenges in terms of public services as well as in terms of security within Honduras. And I'm sure the Nicaraguan government is giving whatever help it can on this sort of basis.
Yeah, and obviously, you know, beyond the government to government level, there is an alignment between the you know, the Sandinista revolution, but it's, you know, the Via Campesina, the Campesino movement there in Nicaragua, and the Campesino movement over the border in Honduras. And that is extremely strong because there was obviously a presence of the Rural Workers Association of Nicaragua there at her inauguration, which was, of course, 1 year ago. I think it's today. Is it today, the anniversary of her inauguration? So that alliance is very strong. And she even appointed Rafael, what's his last name? Well, one of the historic leaders of Livia Campesina is now the vice minister of agrarian reform. And so that's really important. But I do think that she has taken some steps to, you know, sort of express her position in international forums. And, you know, specifically on the whole issue of Peru, you know, SELAC didn't take a very strong position in their final declaration or as a body. I think it's kind of being portrayed as if SELAC is denouncing the coup in Peru and all sorts of things, but that didn't happen actually. And that's not going to happen at this stage because it's a very early stage in this intergovernmental body that's just being developed now and it's just being recovered right now. So what happened is we did have some leaders come out and condemn the coup. And in, you know, her case, she even before this week, you know, since it happened in early December, has been condemning the coup, refusing to recognize Dina Boluarte, and has called for the immediate release of President Pedro Castillo, who Honduras, its government, continues to recognize. And of course, that is because of, you know, all of what Honduras experienced, you know, just 14 years ago. You know, similarly, we saw something very similar take place just a few years ago in Bolivia. So that explains, you know, her reaction to that. But I think in other ways as well, you know, she's had very strong positions. And this is, you know, after taking power after a coup. And I think there are a lot of opposition forces in her government that will try to destabilize things. So I think it's very, it's a very good sign that we've seen her take such strong positions and be so friendly. And of course, tried to really nourish that relationship with Cuba and other countries as well. So we'll wrap it up here, John. Why don't you tell us what are some of the most interesting things that we should look for in Nicaragua in the coming months? I myself hope to be there as soon as possible, but certainly I'll be there for the anniversary of the revolution. What are some exciting things happening that we should follow?
Yes, well, of course, you know, everybody will be very welcome to come on July the 19th to celebrate the anniversary of the revolution. I think in a way, you know, you know, there's so many things have happened in Nicaragua over the last few years. It would be quite nice to say that not a lot is going to happen, that just the government is going to continue to build hospitals, build roads, build social housing, improve the schools, and improve facilities for people. I mean, for example, we've got 70% of the Nicaragua's electricity supply comes from renewable sources, and they're still exploiting new renewable sources like geothermic energy from the volcanoes. We're going to see the opening, I think, of the big new hospital in Bilwi on the Atlantic coast, and no doubt the people who go there in a few months' time will visit that hospital. So I think we just want to look forward to continuing growth in the economy, restoration of tourism. Flights have now been restored from the US. There are now normal airlines flying to and from the US, for example. So it's easier for people to come both from the US and from Europe. And we want to see a period of peace and prosperity, which is something we have been enjoying really since the pandemic effectively ended a year or two back. And I think Nicaraguans just want to live in peace. You made this point earlier, you know, that after 2018, that even people who may initially have supported the coup attempt in 2018 and now realize how destabilizing things were, and that it's really essential now that we've recovered peace and the country's a safe, peaceful country again as it was before, to keep it that way. And we hope that will apply for the whole of the rest of this year.
Absolutely. One thing I'm looking forward to, which is not really a reality yet, I don't think, is that I think it's very cool that for the first time, a CARICOM country will lead SELAC as the pro tempore president. And that's St. Vincent and the Grenadines and President Ralph Gonsalves, who was just honored. He received the Sandino Award? What is it called? What is like the actual name of the award that he was honored with?
Yes, he was honored with the, I can't remember the name of the award, but it was the highest national award, I think, when he was here for the inauguration in January. And by chance, he and I were staying at the same hotel, so I was able to talk to him for a couple of hours the day after the inauguration. We had a very interesting conversation about the Garifuna people who originated in St. Vincent and the Grenadines, and many of them now live either in Nicaragua, in a place that he visited called Orinoco, or in Honduras or Guatemala. So, no, I'm very pleased that he's become the interim president of SELAC. And he's a very strong supporter of Nicaragua. He's a strong supporter of Xiomara Castro. And he knows a lot about Central America. So as well as being well-known in the Caribbean, he's also a friend of Central America and of left-wing governments throughout the continent. So that was a very welcome news, I'm sure. And I'm sure he'll be a very good president. He's an extremely nice guy. And also, I think, a very clever diplomat.
Absolutely. Honored, like just months prior, with the Jose Marti Award in Cuba, and he's a very good friend of President Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela. And so I think this is very important in trying to bridge the relationship between the countries of Central America and the Caribbean, and Latin America and the Caribbean, something that is spoken of a lot. And of course, ALBA TCP has made some concrete moves towards, because there are nine countries, but five of them are East and Caribbean states. It's very important, you know, that relationship is nurtured and is able to grow. But I think, you know, there's still a lot of misconceptions, you know, from these governments, or perhaps from people in these countries who don't really, you know, get good information from Nicaragua about what the situation is. And I think this, it just provides an amazing opportunity. He was able to spend just briefly some time on the coast. And so I think, you know, maybe that's some information that he can take back with him to his colleagues at CARICOM. And, you know, there's a lot that CARICOM and Central America can do. These sort of big forums, such as SELAC, are really dominated a lot of times by South America, and people forget that Central America exists. We're just so small, you know, so small that we just fall off the map. And so I think that it's very exciting. So thank you so much, John, for having this discussion with us. Hopefully it's one of many. I think between the two of us, we have a lot of other colleagues and comrades who have a lot of experience living or writing on Nicaragua, who can share a lot with us. And I think, I think now, from our perspective at Kazakh News, we really would like to, you know, give a platform to more Central American issues. Because of our location in Bolivia and Brazil, and previously in Ecuador, I think we've, you know, followed those issues quite closely. But there are very exciting things happening in Central America and Nicaragua specifically. So thanks so much for coming on with me, writer John Perry, who has been quite active on Twitter, and you might see me retweeting. We'll put his Twitter handle in the description. But thank you so much.